Chapter 22. Back at the gun club's foyer, Kenneth Harcourt had rallied somewhat. He had taken Jackman's suggestion of a drink seriously. Jackman had been thinking more along the lines of hot sweet tea, but the glass of scotch in Harcourt's hand seemed to be doing the trick.
"Before I forget, D.I. Jackman, I can confirm that Arthur Barnes did own the handgun he had with him when he was killed. He said he didn't like leaving guns anywhere near his wife, so he kept his own guns here in the armory. They are listed in his records, all licensed."
"But the Ruger is missing?" added Marie. Harcourt nodded.
"It is."
"Are you up to answering a few questions, Mr. Harcourt?" asked Jackman. They took seats away from the entrance.
"Did you see the car that stopped in front of our police vehicle?"
"Yes, but I only took a cursory glance. I wondered if it was one of our regulars arriving."
"Colour, make?"
"Dark blue, and I think it was a Cherokee 4x4.
"Did you see the driver, Mr. Harcourt?" Jackman asked.
"I'm afraid not. I did see the front window opening, then moments later I heard the gunshot. I ran towards the police car, but the 4x4 sped away, too quickly for me to get the license number." He pulled a face.
"I'm sorry. It all happened so fast."
"It was definitely the front driver's window that you saw open?" asked Murray.
"Oh yes, absolutely. That means the driver fired the shot. So it had to be a handgun. No one could drive and aim a rifle," Jackman said. "Must have packed a punch to go through safety glass and kill with such accuracy."
"It was a powerful handgun, for sure. I know that kind of report," Harcourt said. "A real Dirty Harry type of weapon. As to range, it was just a few meters away. Something like a Smith & Wesson Magnum has awesome muzzle energy. A single bullet from one of those could easily kill."
"He's got himself a bit of an arsenal, then," Marie said.
"I remember that Ralph Renwick was interested in all sorts of guns." Harcourt looked at Jackman. "I rang a couple of places that host these sniper courses, but no one had booked in under that name."
"If you could give us the names and locations of these other clubs, we'll have our officers call round with photos of the man we think is behind all this. It's a million to one chance that he'd show up personally, but it's just possible he met Renwick at a venue such as this." Marie didn't hold out too much hope, but it was worth a try.
"Another thing, sir. I was wondering how our suspect knew that you had a sniper rifle. Who was aware of its existence?"
"Other than family, only Arthur. That makes me think that as Arthur was killed by your suspect, he most likely had dealings with him, and must have spoken about it." He frowned. "Although I can't think why." They heard a vehicle pull up at the entrance. Jackman stood up.
"We have to go, sir. Forensics have arrived. Don't forget, if anyone here has seen the man in the photograph PC Stoner gave you, or Ralph Renwick for that matter, ring us immediately on our personal numbers."
"And tell everyone to steer clear. Neither of them is to be approached at any cost," added Marie.
They made their way down to the stricken police car, where Rory and Spike were just setting down their aluminium briefcases. Marie was pleased to see that the ambulance had gone, meaning Kevin would soon be under the care of Laura Archer. Rory stood back and allowed Spike to take the lead again. He wore an uncharacteristically serious expression.
"I'm sorry for your loss. He was one of your own, wasn't he?"
"He was," said Jackman gravely. "And unless I'm mistaken, he died simply to put another nail in Kevin Stoner's coffin. His career in the police force and possibly his sanity."
Rory raised an eyebrow.
"But why is this Ashcroft creature trying to destroy our Kevin? He's such a sweet boy."
"I wish we knew. It's just one of a dozen unknowns that surround Ashcroft and his motives for doing things," Jackman said.
"He's certainly an enigma, I admit that much."
Rory pushed up his glasses, which had slipped down the bridge of his nose.
"Now, while I have your attention, I had the Torx report back on Arthur Barnes, plus I did a little research on his past medical history. He had been on a serious drug regime, both to cope with pain from his original injury while still in service,
and later for depression and a variety of stress-related problems. He continued to collect his meds from the pharmacy in East Street, even after he hit the streets, but, he paused, we found he'd stopped taking all but the painkillers. There were large doses of analgesics in his system, but no trace of the antidepressants.
There were no tablets in his bag or on his person, were there? Asked Marie.
Probably sold them to get money for food, Jackman said somberly. Could coming off these particular drugs cause paranoia, Rory?
Undoubtedly, and a whole lot of other nasty symptoms, especially if you just stop cold.
Marie felt a pang of sorrow for the dead man. He had gone from war hero to abused husband and had finished up on the streets, killed while being used as a pawn in a madman's evil game. She'd had her fill of the dead, and really didn't want to look at Teal's body. But he was, after all, another victim of the investigation they were working, and she ought to see the scene for herself.
Ernie Teal looked almost comic. Poor Teal. If only he hadn't had that chocolate bar clutched in his hand.
Spike was bending over the policeman, checking the head wound. He looked up when she approached.
We won't be able to tell you anything that isn't patently obvious, Sergeant Evans, not until we've located the bullet. Even then, I doubt whether I'll be able to tell you what kind of gun was used, other than that it was a powerful and lethal pistol and the gunman was a very good shot. If you can track down the gun and we can find the bullet, then we can make a match. Otherwise,
he shrugged.
It's all right, Spike, she said. I wasn't looking for answers. As you say, it's patently obvious what happened. I'm more interested in finding the car that the killer used than knowing the make of the gun.
Marie walked back towards Jackman, wondering if anyone had spotted the blue 4x4 on the security cameras yet. She knew that an attention drone had been issued immediately after the incident occurred, but she hadn't heard of any sightings. There was a good chance they'd find the vehicle nose down in a drainage ditch in some godforsaken part of the Fen, while the killer had driven off in a completely different vehicle. Suddenly, the enormity of trying to find a faceless killer in a big rural county seemed almost too much to cope with. Unless something went seriously wrong with his plans, Ashcroft had the upper hand all the way.
We will get him, Marie.
She hadn't even realized that Jackman was standing next to her.
You've been using that bloody crystal ball again, haven't you, sir?
No need. It's written all over your face.
He gave her shoulder a gentle squeeze.
There's nothing we can do here. Uniform have just told me that none of the club members saw anything that might be of help to us. Most were on the ranges wearing ear defenders and didn't see or hear a thing. After all, gunshots are the norm here, so we're better to carry out a shooting. The only person to notice the car, other than Kevin Stoner, was Kenneth Harcourt. He looked at the police car and the gaggle of white-suited forensic technicians around it. Ella Jarvis has already taken all the photos required, so Rory is arranging for PC Teal to be taken to the morgue. Marie nodded.
Have you spoken to Ruth yet?
Briefly. She is making a second announcement to the media, and I'll see her directly afterwards. By the way, when she said she was drawing in help from around the county, she wasn't joking. From what the commander here tells me, the whole town is crawling with police.
Marie said nothing.
She was coming to believe that all the policemen in the country wouldn't stop Ashcroft and his devious machinations.
Jackman looked at her, head to one side.
Come on, my friend. Where is my DS glass half full? We've been here before, haven't we? Endless night, groping in the dark, and then we get a break.
Someone, somewhere, will see or hear something. Notice an anomaly and put two and two together. It will happen. This new positive Jackman continued to amaze her.
You're right, sir.
It was just a bit of a jolt, seeing Ernie Teal like that. He had no clue when he came out here that it would be his last journey. There was not a trace of shock or horror on his face. It was as if someone just switched him off. They walked back down the path towards their vehicle.
Want me to drive? Asked Jackman.
I'm fine, boss, honestly. I'm over it now, back on track again.
She slid into the driver's seat.
Tell me more about the letter Ashcroft sent you,
I didn't get a chance to see it myself before we dashed out.
Jackman could recite that letter word for word.
He's so confident. It's like he's some kind of pack leader and we're just a bunch of little kids running around playing some stupid game of his invention.
He drew in a long breath.
But I didn't like the reference to Laura not being around.
Do you think there's a direct threat to Laura, boss?
Because if there is...
I know. I do know, Marie. But for some reason, I think it's just another one of his games. More sowing seeds of fear in my mind to unsettle me.
Can you take that risk? Can you be certain it's just a game?
Marie knew that she herself was on Ashcroft's hit list, and at times almost welcomed the thought of a final showdown. But Laura, that beautiful, gentle woman with the cornflower blue eyes and blonde hair, unthinkable. The woman Jackman loved. Ashcroft mustn't hurt her.
I'm certain that's not on his agenda. He could easily have killed her, or taken her, when he broke into her consulting rooms.
Jackman looked at her. He told me to expect the unexpected. Taking Laura would be too obvious. Marie hoped he was right.
So, what nasty, twisted scenario has he planned for us next, I wonder? She mused.
They fell silent, and it lasted all the way back to the station. Alistair Ashcroft entered the church and immediately a sense of peace descended over him. He breathed out and in the silence emptied his mind of the clamour, the voices that hammered at his brain every minute of every day. He sank into a pew and leaned forward, head bowed, as if in prayer.
"Hello, David. Good to see you, my son."
The priest stood at the altar, scraping a small puddle of dried candle wax from the base of one of the ornate candlesticks. Alistair lifted his head, muttered an amen, and smiled innocently at the older man.
"And you, Father, are you well?"
Ashcroft did sincerity very well. As Ezra Lorimer, he had positively excelled himself. They had loved him, every one of them. He was sorry it was over. He'd enjoyed having them all eating out of his hand. The priest was speaking to him, telling him about a new group he was hoping to get off the ground, a weekly get-together in which lost souls could speak candidly to their fellow sufferers about whatever troubled them. Ashcroft was sure he'd get a good response, mostly because of the tea and cake, though he didn't say so to the priest. Troubled souls don't share their demons that easily. He wished the priest every success, and even offered to help out. Father Malone beamed down at the man in the pew.
"You're a good person, David. I would be delighted if you would be generous enough to give me some of your time. God will reward you, you can be sure of that."
Alistair smiled modestly.
"What's the point of life if you can't spare a little of the time that God gave you to help others? I'd be happy to assist."
And he would. He always enjoyed being amongst lost souls, especially the truly damaged ones. They were so malleable. It would be a real tonic. He stared up at the massive cross suspended above the chancel. He had an idea this troublesome priest would come in useful one day. He bowed his head again and the priest moved away to allow his charitable friend David some private time with his God. God, of course, was some way from Ashcroft's thoughts. He was taking advantage of the peace and quiet to work out the timing of his next move in the tournament between him and the police force. Or D.I. Jackman and D.S. Evans, to be more precise. It was a wonder to him, considering the complexity of his various machinations, that he was still way ahead of the game. It came down to basics, didn't it, in the end? Build a good, solid foundation, do your research, and go from there. At least his father had taught him that much. The bastard had built his business empire from nothing, simply through knowing how to play the game. Ashcroft had two things to thank his father for: his business acumen and his death. After his father had driven off the road and killed himself, Ashcroft Jr. had inherited a small fortune, thanks to which he was free to pursue his games. He took a lungful of the dank, incense-laden air. Back to business.
He had to ensure he got the timing right for this next act of the play. He would have to ensure that his trusty employee was in place, ready to take up his role. Ashcroft smiled darkly. He was sure that it would be agreeable. After all, it was in his best interests to comply, and if he were to refuse, Ashcroft would kill him. Simple. There were plenty of others only too happy to take him up on such a lucrative offer.